You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wood.
And I'm Jennifer Connor.
From Equestrian Businesswomen, and you're listening to Equestrian B2B, the podcast that brings together industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and equestrians for conversations about how they build and sustain a successful business.
On today's show, we speak with Ms. Kirsten Rousing about breaking barriers as a woman in the thoroughbred breeding industry, how she moved to Ireland as a young woman and learned the English language, and her advice for women in business.
Having studied in Sweden and concurrently managed her grandfather's Simon Torp stud there, Ms. Rousing left Sweden for Ireland in 1977 to work for the late Captain A.D.D. Rogers Airlie Group of stud farms, initially managing the Baroda stud on the Curra, then moving on to Grange William stud in Maynooth, County Kildare, at the time home of the then leading European sire Habitat. Ms. Rousing left Ireland for Newmarket, the home of horse racing, in time for the 1981 breeding season at her newly purchased Llanwade stud, then 150 rather rundown acres. Further to some judicial planning and a very successful breeding operation, the stud's acreage has now grown to just over 1,200 acres, divided into three completely separate units. Llanwade's and St. Simon's studs in Newmarket and Staffordstown, where weanlings and yearlings are kept, in County Meath, Ireland. Successful stallions standing at Llanwade's under Ms. Rousing's management include champion sires Nininski, his son Hernando, and Selkirk. More recent additions to the Llanwade stallion ranks have been Breeders' Cup sprint winner Bobby's Kitten, German Derby winner See the Moon, and French Derby winner Study of Man.
The winners of well over 2,200 races all over the world have been bred at Llanwade's by Ms. Rousing and her clients in the last 40 years. Amongst the more notable winners bred to date are Alpinista, Fame and Glory, Alborada, Albanova, Caladancer, Petoskey, Arcadian Heights, and Elder Eldavarov. Ms. Rousing has always been interested in all aspects of thoroughbred racing and breeding, particularly in veterinary matters. Ms. Kirsten Rousing is member of many boards, including the Tetra Laval Group, owner of Llanwade Stud, founder and chairman of the Albordada Trust, chairman of International Thoroughbred Breeders Federation, the Thoroughbred Breeders Association, Animal Trust Equine Industry Committee, Federation EFTBA, and EFTBA Veterinary Commission. She has also served several directorships at the National Stud, Jockey Club Estates LTD, British Bloodstock Agency, and Trustee of Animal Health Trust. Ms. Rousing has also received several awards, including a Doctor of University from the University of East Anglia, Great Britain, an Honorary Fellow at Wolfson College, Cambridge University in Great Britain, and an honorary associate at the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons in London.
Hey, Equestrian B2B podcast listeners, ready to level up your biz?
Ride Every Stride specializes in tailoring brand identities for equestrian businesses, from logo development, essential stable accessories, and custom product branding to exclusive awards, VIP event must-haves, and chic apparel. They've got you covered.
Visit rideeverystride.com. Use code B2B15, that's B2B15, at checkout for an exclusive 15% discount.
Elevate your brand with Ride Every Stride, supporting women in business and equestrian excellence. Ms. Rousing, it's so exciting to have you on the podcast. I've had an opportunity to read some articles about you, and I find you so inspiring, and we're just really excited to have you here today with us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you today, of course.
We're going to go ahead and get started, and I just wanted you to kind of talk about, like, when did you realize that you were so passionate about horses, and what drew you to thoroughbred specifically?
Well, I think I realized quite early on as a child that I was very passionate and keen on horses. My late father was a good horseman. He was a rider, and he taught me to ride, but he wasn't involved in thoroughbreds at all. And but he taught me to ride at a very early age. I suppose I was probably about 4 years old. And I was never on ponies. I was just on big half-bred horses and so on. And neither was I in an indoor school. It was all cross-country and leaping fallen trees and things like that. So by today's standards, it was a very dangerous way to bring up a young child. But at least I survived. And I was always very taken by horses, their beauty, their grace. I mean, all horses of all breeds, with the possible exception of some ponies. I think they possess these traits, and they are fascinating animals in every respect, I find. So I was hooked from a very early age. And then later on, as a teenager, I became absolutely passionate about thoroughbred pedigrees. So that's another aspect, you know, more less practical and more academic. But I was really into that, and still am to a degree.
Yeah, pedigrees are pretty deep sometimes. It's so interesting if you go down that rabbit hole. And I find that racing does such a good job. The thoroughbreds, standardbreds, quarter horses, they have the information behind them. I find sometimes it's a little bit harder to get the warm blood breeding, or just our backyard horses here in the United States have their breeding. So I always appreciated, when I was at Blue Chip, being able to look up the pedigree and see who was in the pedigrees. Mm.
Yes, quite. Absolutely. And we have a tremendous advantage there working with the thoroughbred, because he is, with, I believe, the exception of one particular breed of dog, he, the thoroughbred, is the best documented species on earth, and that includes man. So the General Stud Book closed at the end of the 17th century, and as we know, every thoroughbred has to, today, wherever he is in the world, has to be able to be traced in all generations to these individuals that were included in the GSB at the start. But it is absolutely fascinating, I think, to work with pedigrees and to see the similarities and indeed dissimilarities of successful pedigrees all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I had read that your grandfather had some thoroughbreds. Is that correct?
Yes. My grandfather was very interested in animal husbandry in general, and he started out breeding gun dogs in the, I think, 1930s, 1940s, mainly because it was the least expensive species to breed, were dogs. And he was very successful with these dogs. And then he moved on from them to dairy cattle, which he did in the sort of 1950s, 1960s, and he had some fairly perhaps eccentric views how to work with these dairy cattle, and he crossed breed the Swedish dairy cattle with some Danish dairy cattle, which to all intents and purposes were very similar, but I suspect it was rather like breeding a thoroughbred to a standardbred or something like that. So anyway, it created a lot of discontent at the time, but the resulting heifer calves were very successful, and they were then exported all over the world, including to America, which was a big thing in those days. Right. Anyway, so having proved his point, he moved on to horses, and he wasn't a natural horseman by any means, but he just wanted to see if he could do it. So he started with two pretty useless fillies, and they were fillies out of training, the Christmas of 1963. So they were covered in 64, first foals 65. And so I remember them very well. Of course, I was a tiny tot at the time, but I was in from the beginning. And these two fillies, Siri Kit and the Merry Widow, one had never raced. The other one had run some 50-plus times without winning. But they were both half sisters to some good colts. This was in Scandinavia. Yeah. And they bred the unraced one, Siri Kit. She bred a classic winner, 1,000 Guinness winner, Mor Mahal, who won the Danish 1,000. And the other one, the Merry Widow, she bred some perfectly useful sort of top grade handicappers. So it wasn't a lost cause by any means, but that was my introduction, these two fillies. And my grandfather let me have a lot of insight and practical work whilst I was a schoolgirl, of course. Mm-hmm. Then he moved to work abroad in another country, and I was left with the responsibility of running the farm. I was about 16 at the time, and wow. At the time, we had two stallions, about 20-plus mares, and, of course, quite a lot of visiting mares and yearlings and foals, and four or five people employed at the time. And so it was a heavy responsibility for a schoolgirl, I can tell you.
Right. What do you think gave you the confidence to step up at a young age and help manage that?
I don't know if I had much confidence, but I was ordered to do it, so I did it. I suppose with hindsight, I can see how my parents didn't like the idea at all, but as it was my grandfather who ordered me to deal with it, it was difficult for them to object too openly anyway at the time. They hoped I would grow out of it.
I think every parent who has a crazy horse girl daughter hopes that they might grow out of it at some point.
Well, exactly that. And those of us who are lucky, we never do.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I can't say that about myself as far as my parents train standardbred racehorses. So I grew up in it, and I think they actually wished that I had stayed in it to train horses, and I actually don't.
Uh-huh.
It's very funny.
And when you had to take over and start running the business, I read that your grandfather said you need to turn profit in order for it to keep going. How did you kind of set those benchmarks in order to do that?
Well, it was obviously extremely difficult. My grandfather had, he was a great enthusiast, and he became slightly over-enthusiastic in purchasing mares and fillies. So in a few years, we suddenly had 20-plus, 25 mares or something in the space scope of a couple of 4 years or so. So I knew even then that some of these mares were surplus to requirements and so on, but the question, of course, as always, was which ones and so on. So, yes, it was not easy. And then when he went to live abroad, he wanted me to dissemble the whole stud in no time at all. Basically, he gave me a year to get rid of everything, which was pretty well impossible to do. So I asked him could he not give me 2 years and see if I could at least break even or something in that period? And he said, no, absolutely not. You have to get rid of everything, sell everything. And if you can't sell them, then have them shot.
So oh, my gosh.
I said, well, we can't do that. They are pregnant mares and so on. Anyway, so he did come back to me eventually and told me that he, being a very magnanimous person, and there were divided opinions about this, but he thought it was, he said, I will give you 1 year, not two, but you have to make a profit or break even in that time. And I couldn't quite do it, but I brought the losses down by some 95% or thereabouts. Wow. So that was good enough for him, thankfully. And I was allowed to continue on a more commercial basis than he had run it. Yeah. So I started selling all the colts and about half or two-thirds of the fillies. And it was quite, we had good results. This was in Sweden. We topped the yearling sales a couple of times. We bred a Derby winner. We bred other classic winners. And we bred winners in 8 separate countries, which had never been done before from Sweden. So not only the 3 Scandinavian countries, but also the home of horse racing, England, Ireland, France, Hong Kong, yes, and somewhere else I forget, Italy, of course. So, you know, it was very seldom that horses from Sweden went abroad, and even more unheard of, that they could win in countries like that. So that was a great feather in our cap, and it sort of led me to ponder my situation. By that stage, I was at university, and I thought, we've done quite well in Sweden, and what do I do with this stud farm here? The very best I can do is to do the same again. Breed classic winners in Scandinavia and the odd winner abroad. And I felt it wasn't really for me to spend the rest of my life doing that. So I then had to face the bleak possibility of either closing everything down, which indeed eventually became the case, or go abroad and try to pursue a career abroad, which is what I eventually did. And so for a couple of years, whilst I was first in Ireland and then in England, we did keep the stud going in Sweden, but it was dwindling in numbers. But from that, from those days, I still have a mare and her daughter here at Landways in Newmarket, and they are my 7th and 8th generation homebreds.
Oh, wow. So,
they're the only connection still to Sweden. So the mare is fittingly called Memory Lane.
Oh.
And she did quite well, and her daughters are doing well. But that's the only connection still from those days.
Wow, that's special, amazing. Though.
Yeah. And were you afraid when you moved abroad to start a new business or a new venture?
Well, I moved abroad. I was first employed for a good couple of years by a master of the bloodstock industry, the late Captain Tim Rogers of Airlie Stud in Ireland. And he was, as he liked to point out, he was a world authority, which he was. And he was extremely helpful to me, giving me a chance to come out and work for him. no salary, but a house and a lot of practice and education and experience, which I really, really appreciate. And I will always remember how kind and patient he was with me. He had 120 people employed. He ran some 6 or 7 stud farms in Ireland, also one in Kentucky and one in New Zealand. Wow. And so in Ireland, he had 120 people employed, of which me and one other girl.
Wow.
what was that like for you, being so young and being in that environment surrounded by so many men?
Well, I think to some extent the main difficulty was the language for me, because I mean, I thought I was a relatively fluent English speaker, but I'd been taught English in Sweden really by listening to BBC and such like. And of course, coming to the Irish countryside where everybody spoke in a complete Irish brogue, you know, it was quite difficult
for
people to understand what they were saying. And particularly most of them were quite older than I and had very few teeth in their mouth. So it made it even more difficult to understand what was being said. And so in the end, I felt I can't ask people to repeat what they've just said, not more than once anyway. So that was, it was sort of a bit touch and go at times, but I managed somehow. At that time, it's a long time ago, you know, it's 45 more years ago. And I felt very welcome and secure amongst the outdoor staff, the stable staff and so on. Absolutely no problem there. Although I learned some choice Irish expressions which have come in useful later in life, and I made some great lifelong friends in Ireland as well. From another point of view, in a more business business aspect, funnily enough, it was, if anything, and this may be difficult to explain, but if it was, if anything, perhaps almost a help to be young and female in a business context, because nobody took you seriously, nobody was at all shy about talking in front of me, because they thought, well, she doesn't understand any of this and so on. So I was always, well, most often the youngest person in any congregation, and I would sit like a quiet little mouse in the corner and not speak unless spoken to in those days, but with ears flapping. And you know, I found it quite useful.
Oh yeah. And they underestimated you.
Well, I don't know about that, but it was very good. I always recommend the hard school of life. It's a very useful institution of learning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it stood me in very good stead later on.
I read that you also learned English through Agatha Christie novels.
Yes, that's actually true. When I grew up in Sweden, there wasn't much television, and certainly the little there was all in the Swedish language. So I found this collection of Agatha Christie novels from the 1920s, 30s, and I must have been about 12, 13 or so at the time, and I started reading one, and it was so engrossing.
They're my favorite.
And also that I had to keep reading, because one had to know who done it, as it were. And of course, I was too lazy to read with a dictionary, So one sort of eventually understood it all by almost by osmosis. You know, one understood what the words meant, but perhaps without being able to exactly translate it word by word. But also her vocabulary is reasonably limited, very clear, and I would highly recommend Agatha Christie to this day for anyone who wishes to learn English the painless way. So yeah. I was very lucky. Then, of course, I could quite soon read English, but it was rather a surprise to me that English is often pronounced completely differently to the way it's spelt, of course.
Right.
And so on. And plus, it's a language determined mainly by exceptions to all its grammatical rules.
Exactly. Yes. And I think because it pulls from so many other languages and, you know, and changes the words or the spelling as it becomes part of English. And yeah, it's definitely a harder one to learn. But a fun one to speak.
It's great. And I thought the other thing that helped me greatly was to read all the sales catalogs from year to year. Keeneland, November sales, September sales as well, for that matter. Farcic Tipton to an extent, but also the December sales, Mayer's catalogs in England. And of course, the French catalogs made one pick up quite a bit French. I thought to myself that once I started understanding the thinking behind certain horses' names and the way, wordplay and so on was used, then I thought once you understand that, you seem to have some insight into the language anyway.
I have a friend who in fifth grade, he was struggling with reading and they put him in a program and he looked at the teacher and said, "I only need to know how to read a race program. That's all I care about reading. I don't need anything else."
Right. Fully understandable, yes.
And so after working in Ireland, and when did you kind of make the change to England and, you know, move into more of your own business?
Well, it was a gradual process in as much as I had then been in Ireland for a good couple of years, 4 or 5 years. And I felt quite at home in Ireland. I enjoyed life there. I had many friends there. But at the same time, because of the introduction of a very attractive fiscal legislation, taxation legislation in Ireland, which meant that no income on stallion shares and breeding rights were taxes was applicable on this sort of income, which meant a tremendous upsurge for the Irish breeding industry. This was towards the second half of the 70s and onwards. But it also meant, consequently, that stud farm land and stud farms in general, of course, suddenly shot up in value. And the opposite held true in England, where the British economy was going through a very torrid phase in the late 70s, early 80s. Land values fell to the floor and were perhaps a quarter of what they were in Ireland.
Wow.
So this was really what motivated or enforced my moving eastwards at the time, in as much as I'd much rather have stayed in Ireland at the time, but I just could not afford to purchase a place there. So that's why I came to Britain and to Newmarket in late 1980, and it was quite a baptism of fire, and it was the first time I really, really had to stand on my own two feet, particularly from a financial point of view.
Right. And when you moved to England, is that when you purchased your own stud farm, or were you working for someone else there?
I was, in fact, working for the bank that allowed me to. They were so surprised, the bank, when I came and asked to ask them for a loan. They thought, this young girl, what does she know? And why would she want to buy a farm of her own, and so on and so on. And so I remember them asking me if I had a business plan for this. And I thought, they can't know very much about stud farming if they think that it can be described in a business plan. But for some reason, I had, extraordinarily enough, foreseen something of this nature. So I had put together a couple of sentences on a piece of paper, and they were judiciously cut and pasted out of some textbooks I'd had at university. So they suited the purpose, and the bank was surprisingly cooperative. But they asked me if I had any collateral for such a loan, and I said, yes, I have the very thing. I have two mares that I brought with me from Ireland, and you can have them both. They're two very good mares, but you can have them both as collateral. Well, they drew themselves up to their full heights and very, very condescendingly explained to me that, my dear young lady, let us explain to you that you are now here in England. You're not in Ireland, where bloodstock may be accepted as collateral, but certainly we don't do it here. And may we remind you that when one is looking at livestock, one will very soon be looking at dead stock.
Oh, jeez.
There was very little I could do to argue with that. But somehow I managed to persuade them to lend me the money against the farm itself as collateral. Mm-hmm. So in effect, they owned it in all but name. And I worked for the bank. However, they made a mistake, because the two mares that I brought, I bought them both as yearlings, and one I bought for 1,200 Irish guineas, which is about the same in US dollars, as a yearling, and the other one I bought for 12,000 as a yearling, and she took me 3 years to pay in dribs and drabs with the auctioneer, and I shall be forever grateful to Goffs in Ireland, who allowed me the time to pay in installments. This filly, Sushila was her name, and she won two races in France for me, but more to the point, she became the dam of a very, very good horse called Petoskey. He is behind me here in this photograph there. Yeah. When he is winning the Group One King George and Queen Elizabeth Diamond Stakes, beating such luminaries as Oh So Sharp and Rainbow Quest. He was one of the first really good horses I bred. Anyway, so the two mares, with their yearlings about 3 or 4 years down the road from when I purchased Llanwedd, their yearlings paid off the bank in one go. I was so excited and thrilled. I came rushing into the bank with my check from the sales company. And I said, I want to pay you. I want to pay you. And they said, oh, well, that's not so good. It's not a rush and so on. And
that's not a rush.
Would you like to borrow some more money, which is typical when, you know, when you don't need it, then they are quite willing to lend it to you, vice versa. Yeah. But anyway, I said, no. All I want is my freedom. Out from under you and so on. This is not what they wanted to hear, but, but I was eternally grateful to these two mares, Sushila and Rhoda Hexham. And anyway, I was on my way then, thanks to them.
Amazing.
Yeah. What kind of challenges did you face when you were first starting out?
Well, I suppose in a way, having come from rural Ireland, where thoroughbred breeding was definitely a business and a career for those of us involved in it, I then moved backwards in time when arriving in England, which at the time, this was the early 1980s, was still dominated by people who were involved for less than business reasons, and they were passionate and they were wealthy owners who were involved in it much as a hobby. And of course, those days are long gone now, and sadly, we have lost all of these breeders, which were very, very helpful in the old days when you wanted to launch a new young stallion and so on. These were the sort of breeders that you could persuade to use a young stallion. Now they're all gone and replaced by hard-nosed commercial interests.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I could see that. But when you're going through all of this, like, what kind of mindset did you have? Did you have any doubts, or have you always kind of been positive about the path that you were on?
It's a very good question and a difficult one to answer. I suspect if I were absolutely truthful and honest, I led a sort of double life. In one half of my life or more was dominated by the bloodstock industry and what I was doing and so on. And then there were moments of, if not clarity, then perhaps more doubt as to whether this was the right way to spend one's life. But I was never, ever wanting to give it up or feeling doubtful about what I had done or anything like that. I was absolutely clear in my mind that I had done the right thing, leaving my homeland on a single ticket. There was no return ticket involved, and I knew that from the start. And I think I was always relieved and grateful in a way that it had panned out quite reasonably well. Having said that, as we all know, working with animals, working with thoroughbreds, there is always a lot of disappointments, disasters, accidents, and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's never a clear-cut path, is it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, especially with animals. Mm. They like to throw you for a loop quite often.
Yeah.
And would you say your operation is on the smaller side of the other farms that are in your area?
Well, it isn't now, but it for a long time it was. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the industry in Europe has, in particular in England and Ireland, I should say, has consolidated to a great deal. And so we have some mega farms which would be familiar all over the world, mm-hmm. such as obviously Coolmore in Ireland and various Arab-owned farms in England, which have, in some cases, annexes in Ireland. When I first came to work in Newmarket at Llanwade Stud, at the time, there were 27 stallion farms in and around Newmarket, all of them sort of family owned, and most of them with one or two stallions, and tremendous camaraderie and between the various farms. We were all delighted if somebody else had some good winner or so on. And we used each other's stallions and supported each other and so on. And of course, now the 27 stallion farms have all been, with very few exceptions, been gobbled up by the mega farms.
Right.
So we have in Newmarket basically only two independently owned farms left, which is Cheveley Park Stud and myself, Llanwade Stud, and to an extent the National Stud, which is owned by our jockey club. Hmm. So that makes three survivors out of 27.
Wow.
The others have now, they're all gone, but they form part of the major Arab-owned studs. So there are three such in Newmarket, namely Darley, Jadmonta, and Shadwell.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite a dangerous-looking situation from many aspects,
mm.
particularly in terms of competition, of course.
Right. What do you think is the key for you to keep your equine business profitable in the face of, you know, more corporate ventures taking over the industry?
It's difficult because the mega farms here that I recently alluded to, one cannot think that they operate on a normal commercial basis at all.
Right.
They're obviously supported by immense cash injections and so
right.
on. So therefore, it's almost impossible. You can't compare yourself to those. Mm-hmm. And that means that myself and barely a handful of others in this country are now the survivors, and it is quite a question, I suppose, of how long we can survive. In my case, I am not a buyer. I buy very few, if any, animals. I buy maybe a mare once every 12 years or so, which I don't think is excessive.
Right. And,
if even that, because I'd rather keep a few fillies every year nowadays. I keep a handful of fillies that go into training. And if, as has been the case, some of them do prove themselves to be good on the racetrack, they then come back into the stud and they help my stud, my farm accounts greatly by having increased their value. However, as we know, they don't help the cash flow,
mm-hmm.
but they help the accounts, which is obviously a great help in the survival stakes.
Right.
Also, I've been fairly lucky with my choices of stallions to stand here at the farm. We never have many horses standing. The most, I think, we had five at one stage, including American-raced with approval. Well, he was Canadian, of course, but you knew him in America. He stood in Kentucky. And also Le Roi des Animaux, whom you would call Leroy, Brazilian, but winner at Woodbine and in Kentucky. So they were both here. So I've had, but basically my most important stallion successes have been my original stallion, Niniski, his son, Hernando, also Selkirk, bred and raised by George Strawbridge Jr., and then latterly, Archie Penko by King Mambo, very, very good horse, sadly died early from leukemia, age about 12. So he was a great loss. And then at present I have a German Derby winner, Cedar Moon, son of Cedar Stars. And he is, although standing with me here in Newmarket, he's a champion sire in Germany. Because he's got fantastic results there, but also throughout Europe. And then my great hope is a young horse called Study of Man. He is the only son of Deep Impact at stud in England, and one of only two in England and Ireland. His first crop are now three-year-olds, and he had a group winner in his first crop of two-year-olds last year. So we are very hopeful about him. I slightly digressed from the question, I'm sorry. I can't quite remember where we started.
I guess my question is, did you kind of have to put blinders on to what everyone else is doing and just focus on your business and what you knew you wanted to do, and in order to keep it profitable?
Yes, I must admit you have a point there. I did wear blinkers to an extent. I felt I had to, because I could not compete with others doing exactly the same as everybody else. Mm-hmm. So for instance, 30 years ago or 25 years ago, everybody wanted Sons of Sadler's Wells, and then eventually they wanted his grandsons by Galileo and so on. And I thought, as a smaller farm, I must try to offer mare owners an alternative to all these obvious bloodlines. So that's why, for instance, Niniski was arguably the best stallion son of Nijinsky in the world. Nobody had foreseen that, but he was an instant and great success. Even though he himself was an out-and-out stayer, he got a champion two-year-old in his first crop, and we went on from there. So he, as some pedigree gurus would remind us, he was, although he was by Nijinsky, he was quite a different type to, for instance, than other Northern Dancer line horses. He was a difficult physical type as well. But anyway, as was Nijinsky. And then I went on with Selkirk by Sharpen Up, and the other two very good Sharpen Ups were the own brothers, Crease in this country and Daisy's in Kentucky. It was great to have a son of Sharpen Up, and he was well received, and he was an instant and indeed lasting success. So I had to offer something slightly out of the ordinary, because it wouldn't have been much good for me to try to just ape the rest of the industry. But it's dangerous, because you sometimes can become slightly too ambitious and esoteric and try to offer people something they don't understand at all. I mean, Standing Hernando, who had never raced in England, he raced in in France, Ireland, Japan, and the US, but never in England. So it's quite difficult to explain to mare owners why they should use him. But he came up with a French Derby winner holding court in his first crop, and off we went from there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And now you see I have See the Moon, who only raced in Germany, but he, when he came here, his reputation had gone before him. He was actually at one stage favorite for the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe and so on. And he was the first son of Cedar Stars at stud in England. So he wasn't difficult to launch. In fact, he was easy to launch and so on. But sometimes breeders need a little bit of international outlook, which is difficult to come by.
What do you think your biggest success has been? Like, between it all, your farm, your horses, something you've accomplished yourself, what is your biggest success?
I think my biggest success is to have survived in the game.
Yeah. and do you see yourself as a woman who breaks barriers in the thoroughbred industry?
There have always been women in the industry, but before me, I think it's fair to say that most of them were maybe widows, daughters, divorcees, and so on. Wives, indeed, but there were very few single women. There's a few exceptions. Helen Alexander in Kentucky obviously has done extremely well, but she had a background, family background in the industry, and so on. And whereas I had no family background, and on top of that, I was an outsider, a foreigner, which was doubly or trebly handicapped, really. Hmm. But I've enjoyed every minute of it, and I'm very, very grateful to have been in this industry for such a long time. And I hope I've been of some help to others in the industry. I do my best anyway.
Yeah. We've kind of covered how you handled dealing with being in this male-dominated industry, but are there any tips that you can give to our listeners that might help them along the way?
Well, patience is a great virtue, isn't it? I think you must be don't doubt your own capability. Believe in your own capability, and if you believe in yourself, you will eventually be accepted. I'm not advocating going out in a bombastic way, telling other people what to do, and only I know it, and all that sort of thing. And there are times when one obviously has to bite together and let things pass, you know?
Yeah.
But I think patience is the name of the game. Attention to detail in general, and so on. And again, I've said it before, but the great university of life, there is nothing to beat it. And practical experience and seeing as much practice as you possibly can, and preferably in different surroundings. Myself, I was lucky. I started in one country. I worked in France with yearlings. I worked in Ireland with breeding stock and so on before coming here, and I've been allowed to travel and see breeding operations in various countries, India, South Africa, amongst them, and so on. So there's always something to learn. But I think if you have don't lose confidence in yourself, mm-hmm. even if things are not going particularly well, would be my word of advice.
Wonderful. And so at the end of each episode, we ask the same four questions to each guest. And Jen Connor asks the first question.
What is one action that women can take to make a big difference in their lives?
Well, this is really what I alluded to before. I think it is to believe and have confidence in your own capability.
Mm-hmm. And what is the best habit that keeps you motivated personally?
I think it's a passion for what I do. I so like what I do, even whatever it is, if it's standing in a muddy field with sleet and rain, driving around and looking at yearlings, or indeed doing office work, which is perhaps repetitious, but always interesting to me. I don't mind it at all. So the passion to do what you're doing is a great help.
I love that. What's your favorite horse movie?
Now, here, I'm going to disappoint you. I don't think I've ever watched a horse movie.
Do you have a favorite horse book?
Yeah, there are many. But there is a newly published absolute masterpiece of many thousands of pages. It's two volumes of thousands of pages each, and it's the history of every single racecourse in Britain. And no one could possibly read it from cover to cover, but it's a marvelous book which will last me the rest of my lifetime to dip in and out of. I will get you the title of it. I just can't offhand remember it.
That's amazing.
And do you have any recommendation of someone who could be a future guest on this podcast?
Yes, I do, actually. I would recommend my great friend, Emer Mulhern, who is chairman of Gough's Bloodstock Sales in Ireland. I'm sure she's the only woman chairman of any major bloodstock sales in the world. And she's the consummate and true professional, and she is a horsewoman to her fingertips, and absolute expert at what she does, and great with people as well as horses.
That's great. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. It's really cool to hear your story and everything that you've accomplished. So we appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed going back in time, and hopefully there is still some future left. And we hope, of course, to have some nice winners this year.
Yes. Absolutely. This is coming out the beginning of May. It'll be out just before the Kentucky Derby. So.
Oh, great. Well, look for a horse I bred called Sons and Lovers in England. He's by Study of Man, and he would have run by then.
Okay,
he will.
There's our inside tip.
There may be some others. I'll find the title of that book and put it in an email to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Tired of searching multiple websites for equestrian products and services? Wish you could browse horses for sale and order supplements in one convenient place? Equivant was created by Horse Girls, who are dedicated to making it easy for fellow equestrians to find what they need for them and their horses.
Equifont partners with small equestrian businesses to advertise products, services, and horses for sale on one convenient marketplace. Shop on Equivant.com to find horses for sale, grooming products, supplements, riding apparel, trainers and vets in your area, and much more. They really do have everything you need for you and your horse.
That was an awesome interview. I was so nervous and so excited to talk to her because she just has so many cool things about her.
She's really impressive. Yeah. I the first thing that I read about her was an article in the Telegraph, the British newspaper, and it just went on and on of like, all these accolades. And I'm like, wow, this is, she's done a lot in her life. And from where she started to where she is now is incredible and so impressive again. And, but you can still tell talking with her, like, she's a horse girl.
Yes.
She's a horse person. Like, she loves horses.
Yes. And my racing people are like gonna love it because all the pedigree information and the talk about the horses, and her mind just works like so many brilliant racehorse people that I know. They can recall horses from years ago. My dad can tell you equipment that horses wore when he was a kid.
Yeah. Her encyclopedic knowledge blew me away. Like, she could just go on, and she's not like looking at a book or consulting papers or anything. It's all in her head. And like you said, you can tell why she's been so successful. You know, absolutely. It's obvious she's passionate. It's obvious she knows so much about the industry. And I just really enjoyed hearing her talk.
I know, it makes me want to move and go work for her just to be near her and have like, get that knowledge that, oh, the vibe, like she has a vibe about her. Mm. That's so cool. She's businesslike, but approachable and
sense of humor.
And yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was like really cool. And to do all that she did when she was younger and take care of a business and have the insight to say, oh, well, let me make it profitable, before you just sell it, and being so young and going to school and handling all of that and managing people at the same time. It's just people like that. I always love to know what makes them tick.
Yeah. I remember reading her saying that, you know, when she took over her grandfather's breeding operation, and he told her she had a year to make it profitable. She was in university, so she would be staying up until, you know, all hours of the night helping mares foal, and then would have to go to school in the morning. It's, I can't imagine, like, college is hard enough without, and then breeding horses is incredibly difficult in the time that you have to put into it. And she did both, and she made it work.
Right.
Like, it didn't fall apart. She was successful at it.
Yes. And then moved to another country where she didn't really speak the language, and to like learn, it must have been like drinking out of a fire hose. And then
she sat there and listened to everybody. Yeah. And I think that is incredible advice when you're starting out or you're moving into something that you don't know as much about and you want to know more. That's what you do, is you find the best people and you listen.
You listen and you be a sponge.
Yeah.
You like soak that up.
We all, you know, we talk about with like at Hunter Jumper shows, one of the best things you can do is go to the Grand Prix schooling ring and watch all the top riders on how they warm up their horses. Like, you can learn more there than watching them in the show ring.
Yeah. And listening. Yeah. Listening is a huge part of communication that I think we've lost a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good reminder of that. And I also liked her talking about patience, because in a world where everything is instant gratification, I think looking at the long game instead of the short game is a very good perspective. And I do think that that's helped her keep competitive and stay and survive against much bigger competition. It had to be. I mean, I just can't imagine how drastically the business has changed since she started her business in England. And, you know, the influx of billions and billions of dollars into thoroughbred racing because, you know, a few people like horses and they just happen to be the wealthiest people in the world, you know, like,
yeah,
it's really, really changed. Like she said, with the, you know, losing so many family owned farms in her area, and she has survived and thrived. And I hope it goes on to, you know, continue to be one of the best stud farms in the world, because she put so much into it to make it successful. I don't know. I can't think of another descriptive term.
No, I know, the passion just came across so much, and I hope that it wears off on me by osmosis.
Right. Yeah. It's really interesting. So I think we got lucky being able to speak with her.
Yeah, I feel so lucky to be able to track down, especially in breeding season when it's really busy, and she was taking the time. And we're in America. We're not even in the UK. Right. So
yeah, we're no one. And she was like, sure, I'll talk to you. Like, yes. That's really cool.
Yeah, I kind of like felt like we were sitting in her office with her while we were doing the interview. And that was super cool. So I am going to be like tingling and vibing the whole rest of the day as I go through the rest of my day. And I hope that the rest of you enjoyed it. And you're going to find the links to today's guest and the show notes at www.eqbusinesswomen.com. Equestrian B2B is out twice a month on the 1st and the 15th.
You can find out more at eqbusinesswomen.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Find Equestrian B2B wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow, subscribe, and leave a review. You can have all 20 plus shows of the Horse Radio Network with you wherever you go with their free app for iPhone and Android. Go to your app store and search Horse Radio Network.
Now, go have patience.